And welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. An interesting day yesterday. I got to the Sunday Lansing State Journal later than usual after a family member had rode the river trail on her bike, and she saw the bald eagle's nest, which sits in the middle of a marshy little island in the middle of the Red Cedar River, and she ran into a photographer nearby who shared with her that someone is flying a drone near the eagle's nest. This is Lansing's first nesting bald eagle in who knows how many years. Safely, I'm sure you could say decades. Some people think it might be a century. I really have no idea. But my point is, later in the day, I read the op-ed from Christopher Hull in the Journal, who also alludes to someone flying a drone near the eagle's nest. The question becomes, who, if anybody, has the authority to look into this? The DNR, maybe? I don't know. But it would seem that someone should do something, if nothing more than try to persuade this person to reconsider what he's doing. It would seem that any nesting bird, especially one that's spent years on the endangered species list, any nesting bird can withstand only a limited number of disturbances if it's nesting before it flies the coop. Don't get it. Current State on WKAR, the months-long discussion about whether to raise Michigan's sales tax by a penny is nearing an end. Voters will decide the issue next Tuesday. According to Michigan's Citizens Research Council, the measure would eventually generate about $1.3 billion additional dollars to be spent on the state's roads and bridges. It creates a new formula for assessing the state's gas tax, which would be tied to the wholesale price of gasoline. At current prices, it would go up about 10 cents per gallon. Whatever the increase, it would be lessened somewhat by the removal of sales tax from gasoline. And although some low-income Michigan households will see their tax bite go down, several estimates put the increase in taxes for the average Michigan household at around $500 a year. For more on this much-debated measure, how it works, and why it makes sense, we welcome one of the key supporters of the measure. Roger Martin runs the public campaign dubbed Say Yes to Roads. He's a partner in Martin Waymire Advocacy in Lansing. Roger, good to see you.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
We'll also point out that before the end of the week, we will be hearing from an opponent or opponents of Proposal 1. Roger, this is a complicated issue with a lot of ramifications, but a central feature of Prop 1 is that it would remove the sales tax from gasoline purchases. Is that because none of those dollars have ever gone to roads anyway?
That's correct, Mark. We have this crazy, convoluted, nonsensical system in Michigan, and have had it forever, on how we fund the maintenance and how we fix our roads and bridges. So when we go to the pump, we pay three different taxes. We pay the federal gas tax, we pay a state gas tax, and we pay the 6% state sales tax. And as you correctly just stated, that's not a penny of that 6% sales tax goes to roads, bridges, transportation. It goes to local governments, and it goes to K-12 schools. That's the way we've always done it as a state. So Proposal 1 basically scraps the state sales tax. It scraps the 6% sales tax.
From gasoline.
That's correct, from gasoline. Replaces it with a wholesale gas tax. And under our Constitution, every penny that we would pay in taxes going forward would have to, again, under our Constitution, this is not a law, this is the Constitution, would have to go to roads, bridges, and transportation.
But so it does tidy things up a little bit. Yeah, it clarifies things a little bit.
It does. You know, we have a complex system now, very complicated, and that's why, you know, you said the ballot proposal is complicated. I don't know that I would disagree with that. But when you're undoing something that is complicated, it almost takes
complicated.
Yeah, it sure does.
It would raise a little over $1.2 billion a year for roads, but it wouldn't all be directly spent on roads until 2018, I want to say. Why the delay?
Well, here's what the legislature, when they crafted Proposal 1 back at the end of December, here's what their rationale was for that. We have debt right now that we're paying off in the state that went, going back to the early 1990s, instead of raising the gas tax, or instead of raising new revenues to fix roads, which most people agree would be the responsible thing to do over time, The legislature and the governor decided to borrow a bunch of money to fix the roads. So we're paying off that debt. So because Proposal 1 would not take effect until October 1 of this year, the revenues would still be coming in the meantime. So the legislature, Republicans especially, said, why don't we use some of this early revenue to pay down the debt that we as taxpayers are paying? It will reduce borrowing costs dramatically by hundreds of millions of dollars over time. And then once we have a new construction season and all the dollars are there and we can manage all these new road projects coming in, then let's put all the money toward roads. This is about paying debt. This is about paying down debt.
And some people are grumbling about that. So they say, why we're going to raise the money immediately. Why not put it into the roads immediately?
I got to tell you, Mark, we've in the course of the last 9 weeks when this campaign started in earnest back in early February, we've probably done now as a coalition 200 or so public presentations to groups across the state on Proposal 1. And that is one of the questions we get. We get, why did they do this? Why did they do that? Why did they do this? And after you can spend 15, 20 minutes speaking to a group, you can see the reluctance and the skepticism disappearing when they understand that, oh my gosh, so that was a good fiscal move. That was fiscally smart to try to pay down debt instead of just letting the money sit in the bank and still incurring the debt.
It would then, Proposal 1 would increase the gasoline tax itself, though, as well, which hasn't gone up for 20 years or thereabouts.
As a state, we have raised the state gas tax one time in the last 31 years. One time in the last 31 years. Now, there are probably about 26-27% of the voters in the state who under no circumstances will ever support a gas any tax increase for anything ever, no matter what. But I don't think it is unreasonable to suggest that two gas tax increases over the course of 31 years is not reasonable. That is not an unreasonable proposition.
But how much, I alluded earlier, I am under the impression that at current prices, the gas tax would go up by about 10 cents per gallon.
Is that may or may not be accurate. It's a very difficult thing to accurately contend or to calculate. MDOT says it'd be about a nickel a gallon. Others are saying around 10 cents. So probably the truth, if you assume all the different factors that people are putting into their calculations, is probably in the middle there somewhere.
Roger Martin's our guest. He is the head of the Say Yes to Roads campaign for Proposal 1, supporting the increase in the state's state's sales tax by a penny. When you encounter an undecided voter, then, Roger, what are your key reasons that you cite for voting yes on this bill?
Well, again, for the first time, we have this complex system and nonsensical system that we use to fund our roads and bridges, and this totally reconstructs that. It rebuilds it. And for the first time, every penny we pay in taxes at the gas pump will have to go to fix roads, bridges, will have to go to transportation. It really, really simplifies how we do this in Michigan, how we fund our roads and bridges, and establishes that guarantee that we've never had before.
We will also point out once again that we will, current state, will be having an opponent or opponents of Proposal 1 on our program before the end of the week. Let's review what some of the many of the critics of Proposal 1 are saying and get your response. The sales tax is a regressive tax. It hits low-income people relatively harder than, say, an income tax.
There is a lot of economic theory that supports that. By itself, a sales tax increase by itself is a regressive tax, according to a lot of economic theorists. However, Proposal 1 also includes a $260 million tax cut for low-income workers by restoring the earned income tax credit. So, you know, there are a couple of organizations in the state who really all the time advocate on behalf of low-income workers. One is the Michigan League for Public Policy. Michigan Children's is one. There are others. All of them support Proposal 1 because of that restoration of the earned income tax credit. Low-income workers, frankly, under this and factually under this proposal, by and large, get a tax cut here.
There is, as I'm sure you've noticed, a good deal of popular irritation over the legislature simply not passing a measure. Is that you must be contending with that in some way, shape, or form?
We hear that everywhere we go, Mark. And what the legislature, you know, this was the last legislature who put this on the ballot, not the current legislature, but the last legislature. Those lawmakers who were here and did that said we did our job because the only way under the Constitution you can raise the sales tax is to go to the ballot. Legislature has no authority to do it on its own. Their contention is that they did their job, you know, and like you said, others will argue, no, that they should have solved it instead of sending it to us to solve.
Well, you hear people say we got a $54 billion state budget. There must be one. Well, there must be a billion or two rattling around in there somewhere to pay for the roads.
You know, and of all the arguments that the opponents have, that is probably the most nonsensical and irrational and frankly misleading, if not outright deceptive. We have $53 billion or so that do come into the state that the legislature is in charge of appropriating to various programs and services. All but about $10 billion of that are federal funds that are earmarked legally for only certain things. So the legislature and the governor basically have discretionary spending authority over about $10 billion. Look, I'm not an expert on the state budget, but if you ask the people who are, like the Senate Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, two very small government, fiscally conservative Republicans, the governor, all of these folks take a constitutional oath of office every year to pass a balanced budget. If you ask them, is there $1.2 billion more every year in the state budget to fund roads? They'll tell you you're crazy because it's just not there. They will also note again that we've raised the gas tax one time in 31 years. We've raised the sales tax. Last time we raised the state sales tax, Judd Heathcote was the head basketball coach here at MSU. So they will point that out and say, you know, it's not an unreasonable proposition to be raising taxes once every 21 years or twice every 31 years.
Taxpayers would be essentially giving themselves a tax increase. The Mackinac Center estimates the average Michigan household will see a $525 tax increase if Proposal 1 passes.
For me to sit here and say this is not a tax increase would be a flat-out lie. It is a tax increase. There's no question about that. But again, we've had one gas tax increase in 31 years. We've had one sales tax increase in 21 years. I'm a business owner, Mark. No one likes to pay higher taxes, but sometimes it just becomes necessary.
It would raise vehicle registrations as well, correct?
It changes the way we do vehicle registrations in a very complex way. But yes, vehicle registration fees would eventually go up as well.
Supporters of investment in public transit have a reason, though, to get behind this. Just to look at the other side here, there's more dollars for public transit, correct?
There is, and it's because there's a law that was passed in 1951, I guess is the best way for me to say it. It's called Public Act 51, and it sets in state law a formula that all gas tax dollars have to be distributed under. And under that formula, about one out of every $10 goes to mass transit, goes to public transportation, bus systems, dial rides, et cetera, et cetera. So legally, if you're raising the gas tax here, those dollars have to go to mass transit. It's part of the law. And you know, if you look at the city of Detroit and you look at other regions of the Grand Rapids and even Traverse City, Ann Arbor, all of the local leaders there and a lot of the legislators from those areas are advocating more mass transit, more public transit, because young people today, that's the way they like to travel. There's fewer and fewer people buying cars. Big corporations that are looking for talented young people are locating in areas that have alternatives to driving, and certainly public transit is one of those alternatives that really needs to be funded.
There is a diverse coalition backing this proposal. I think that is quite striking. Who is in this group?
There's 120 different members, and I think this segment's about 15 minutes long, and if I started naming them all, we'd run out of time real quick. But I mean, yeah, we've got virtually all of the major business organizations in the state. Every regional chamber of commerce you can pretty much name: Grand Rapids, Detroit, Lansing, Flint, Genesee, Traverse City. We have the Small Business Association of Michigan. We have the sheriffs, police officers, firefighters, all of those first responders who see daily the carnage that is created on our roads because they've deteriorated into the dangerous condition they're in today. We have education groups, we have environmental groups, we have counties, townships, and we have the mayor of Detroit, we have the Wayne County executive. I can just keep going on and on and on. Carl Levin, U.S. Senator Carl Levin, former Congressman John Dingell, Roger Penske, one of the most regarded business leaders in the country.
All the same, the polling hasn't been encouraging for supporters. An Epic MRA poll released the first of the month showed 24% support, 66% opposition. Do you think you've changed any of those minds in the past few weeks?
You know, the old cliche is the only poll that matters is the one that it's taken on Election Day. We're ignoring the polls. We're working as hard as we possibly can. We have a very robust to get out the vote effort right now that we've moved all campaign resources into at this point. We have phone banks going on in West Michigan. A phone bank opens in Lansing today. We've been active in Detroit and Flint with phone banks for the last week or 10 days or so. You know, what we're concentrated now on is getting our people out to vote on May 5. If given the size, the breadth, the depth of our coalition, if those members of the, and those constituencies of the coalition get out and vote on May 5th, we have a good chance to win.
A good chance. Is there any serious misinformation in circulation out there, in your view? Are you hearing people demonstrate any consistent misunderstanding of anything in the law? Or is the greater challenge just getting people to look at it closely in the first place?
The big challenge is to get people to take the time to understand it, to really look at Proposal 1 and ignore the sound bites that are coming from the other side, that this is some special interest money grab, that this is that's just preposterous. I don't believe anyone considers police officers, firefighters, ambulance, or EMTs, teachers. Those are not special interests. Those are the people we rely on every day to do what we do in our lives. But, you know, the biggest bit of misinformation out there is this notion that there is some viable plan B. And I'm hoping that we eventually strike the words plan B from our lexicon, because I'm tired of hearing it. You know, if you ask the people, again, who are in charge of writing a state budget every year, is there a viable alternative that can fix our roads without decimating all those essential services that we rely on in Michigan? Higher education, for example, K-12 schools, local revenue sharing that are used to fund our police and firefighters in our communities, in our neighborhoods. Senator Meekhoff, the Senate Majority Leader, Speaker Cotter, the governor will all say there is no viable plan B. If you can't get a plan that fixes the roads and it can get 56 votes in the House and 20 votes in the Senate and can get signed by the governor, then it's not a plan. It's fairy dust, it's unicorns, and it's a wish. It's not a plan.
I will point out the current state has reached out to Paul Mitchell, former candidate for U.S. Congress, who is the head of the Say No to Higher Taxes campaign, which is aligned against Proposal 1. We hope to have Mr. Mitchell on the program on Friday. For now, we want to say thanks to Roger Martin, head of the Say Yes to Roads campaign, a partner in Martin Wehmeyer Advocacy in Lansing. Roger, thank you. Good luck.
Thanks, Mark.
When you think of American food, you probably see hamburgers, hot dogs, maybe French fries, but there's a lot more to food culture in the United States than typical drive-through fare. The evolution of what and how Americans eat is the focus of a new exhibit at the Broad Art Museum. It's being curated by students in the MSU Museum Studies program who have backgrounds in everything from art history to zoology. Current State's April Van Buren talked with MSU Museum Studies Director Susan Bandes about the exhibit and asked her how she settled on food as the topic for this exhibit.
Well, I have taught this course before, and because we have only a semester, actually less than 14 weeks to develop the course, I give the students a very broad topic. So in this case, it was food/nurture. And there are students from anthropology, history, art education. Often we have zoology. So the theme has to be broad enough that people can bring their own perspective to it.
And can you tell me, as you put this exhibit together, sort of what themes came about? I'm imagining that there are things that sort of popped out as people were choosing what things they wanted to include in this exhibit.
Some of the themes that came out were food as propaganda, food as economy, the evolution of dining from the beginning of the 20th century to contemporary, and sustainability, so very broad themes. So some of the objects are fairly obvious. A milk crate and glass bottles from what used to be the MSU dairy. Two pop images of a pinup girl and a Coca-Cola bottle.
And you mentioned the evolution of dining and that's part of this exhibit. Could you talk a little bit about what that looks like in America, the evolution of how people eat and where people eat?
We have an image that was taken during the Farm Security Administration in the Depression, and it's an image of a hefty woman. You see her from the back, you don't see her face, and she's preparing a meal in a kitchen. We move from that to an image of two women at a lunch counter. There's also an image of a diner, the Market Diner in New York. And then one student chose a Frank Lloyd Wright chair and stool. And we have some Russell Wright dishes. So we move from very traditional, you know, where people sat down for their evening meal together, to the informal way we dine now, and we dine out a lot. So that's one of the examples of the transformation of food culture that's in the exhibition.
And I know that this doesn't just hit on how Americans eat or what Americans eat, but also how food ties into American culture. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how food has played a role in what it means to be American.
Well, one good example to answer that is a World War I poster that we have in the exhibition. And it is urging Americans to ration food so that the soldiers overseas will have enough to eat. So clearly that's art as propaganda, art as economy. And I don't think we really think about that anymore. I mean, what we have such an abundance of food. There's another image in the exhibition, an Andy Warhol photograph that shows a flea market where they're selling huge amounts of bananas and other fruits. So we move from the beginning of the century where there was not the abundance that we're so used to.
That's interesting that you bring up Andy Warhol, because I think when you think about food and art, a lot of people, what pops to mind is probably that Campbell's soup can. In this exhibit, what pieces stand out to you as kind of illustrating the relationship that food has had, not just to American culture, but to American art?
Well, we do have an Andy Warhol, and it's a soup can, but it's not a tomato soup can. It's a wonton soup can, and it's a small Polaroid. So at some point, Campbell's, in response to changing immigrant patterns, decided to do a wonton soup can. It's not something I really thought about. So it's a little twist on that typically American sort of diet.
What does that say about how American food culture started to change in that moment?
Well, that Polaroid certainly shows that the influence of immigrant cultures have expanded to beyond those communities. So, you know, everybody eats Italian food, we eat Chinese food, albeit an American kind of Chinese food. So I think that image speaks to that.
It seems like it's kind of an exhibit of cultural history that involves both, you know, food objects and art and history all wrapped up into one, part of a historical moment rather than just maybe one artist.
Exactly, yeah. We have many artists. There are about 20 pieces in the exhibition. We begin in the late 19th century and go to about 1990s.
And are there any other pictures in here that really struck you?
There is one image by the pop artist Mel Ramos, and it's a very voluptuous pinup nude behind a Coca-Cola bottle. And the Coca-Cola bottle is exaggerated in terms of its size. So it's very suggestive. It talks about the advertising age, about the ubiquitousness of Coke in our life, and start thinking about processed foods. So it's a lot about commercialization of our food culture at the same time as probably being a bit offensive to some people. And in fact, when he did it in the 1970s, the feminists were really annoyed at him. But he was looking at Playboy magazines and he was looking at the ubiquitous Coca-Cola bottle. So he brought these together in one image and it's quite striking.
And can you give me an example of two objects that you might group together to illustrate a certain historical moment or some of the context behind those objects?
In the Benefactors Gallery, there's a series of black and white photographs, and one of them shows an African-American woman and a white woman at a lunch counter. It happens to be in New York in the 70s, but it evokes the civil rights movement, and the two women are not, they're just adjacent to each other, they're not together. And there's a real uncomfortableness in their relationship to each other. So that is near an image of a family in a dining room, very kind of middle class. You can tell that by the drapes that are hanging and some of the mismatched plates and cups. And there's a father and a son, and from the back you see the grandmother. So, you know, wonderful juxtaposition of people eating outdoors by themselves and a family scene.
Obviously, part of this project is that it's a project for the students, and it's for them to learn how to put together an exhibit and all that goes into picking the objects and describing the objects. But for people who want to come by and see this, what do you hope that they get out of it?
Well, I hope people will see a really interesting juxtaposition of objects that you wouldn't normally see in the Broad. And that's one of the things that I find very exciting about working with students from multi-disciplines, because they're looking at pieces in totally different ways than I do. But it's an interesting juxtaposition. So we have Kellogg cornflake boxes from the MSU Museum, which you would never see in an art museum. But within this context, I think they make a visitor think about things differently.
That was Current State's April Van Buren talking to MSU Museum Studies Director Susan Bandies about American Appetite, a new exhibit at the Broad Art Museum looking at the evolution of American food culture. Students in the Museum Studies program will be hosting a gallery talk this Saturday, May 2nd at 2 p.m. The exhibit will be on display through May 3rd. Coming up in our program, about 350 troops have deployed to the Middle East recently to eliminate the threat posed by ISIS. Those troops are based here in Michigan. Coming up, Current State's Kevin Lavery talks about that mission with Michigan Air National Guard Commander Brigadier General Leonard Isabel. That and more after the break.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through
marching.
All you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The morning's news between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
WKAR is supported by Capital Area Women's Lifestyle Magazine's annual 80s Flashback Fundraiser on Saturday, May 9th at the University Club, featuring live 80s music, Big Hair Station, and more. Ticket information at cawlm.com/events. And by Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, a business networking and advocacy organization in the greater Lansing community for more than 100 years. Membership information can be found at lansingchamber.org.
And if you're following the fortunes of Joshua Davis on NBC TV's The Voice, there's another watch party to cheer him on here tonight. Free admission to Celebration Cinema in Lansing. The show starts at 8 p.m. The Michigan Air National Guard has sent troops to the Middle East, in the words of military officials, to eliminate ISIS, the terrorist group responsible for numerous acts of violence in Iraq and Syria. About 350 airmen based at Selfridge Air National Guard Base near Detroit are now in the region, as well as 12 A-10 Thunderbolt aircraft. The A-10, nicknamed the Warthog, is equipped with a high-powered rotary cannon capable of destroying a tank. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with the commander of the Michigan Air National Guard, Brigadier General Leonard Isabel, about why the troops were deployed.
What it means is they're going to be involved with a variety of missions with the intent of eliminating the threat to the coalition troops as well as to the innocent civilians in Iraq.
Are you at liberty to say where they're going?
No, I'm not. Due to operational security considerations, we would like to protect our folks as well as the host nation. And we're not going to give you that information at this time.
As I expected. What skill sets do these 350 or so airmen bring to this particular mission?
Again, they bring a number of skill sets to our force and our team. Obviously, we have aviators whose job is to fly the aircraft that are deployed, as well as all the men and women whose jobs there are to maintain and support those who do all those different jobs.
The 127th flies the A-10 Thunderbolt. It's also called the Warthog. That particular aircraft has been in service for more than 35 years, and the Air Force has been weighing whether to retire it. What might this mission, or maybe even future missions with the A-10, mean for the future of that program, and would that really have an impact on Selfridge Air National Guard Space to continue playing a viable role in our national defense?
Well, first of all, the aircraft is old. However, it's still very viable, as evidenced by the fact that it's deployed now in service to our country. The aircraft itself, our chief of staff of the Air Force has identified the issue with the A-10's continued service as a financial issue. If he could keep all the aircraft in service, he would, but he had to make some tough choices with the intent of modernizing our force. So unfortunately, his recommendation was to retire a fleet such as A-10, which is older, in favor of modern aircraft. And it was a tough decision. In terms of the viability for Selfridge, there are a number of options on the table for follow-on aircraft. The Air Force official offer is additional KC-135s to go with the KC-135 air refueling aircraft that we currently have based at Selfridge. In addition, we have recently begun discussions of basing another fighter-type aircraft, such as the F-16 at Selfridge, and that's our preference given the long history of fighter-type missions at Selfridge, as well as synergies with other installations around our state.
So at this point, again, General, it's safe to say that's a recommendation, not yet a done deal. And recommendations don't always become policy, and if they do, sometimes it takes a long time for that to happen.
Well, obviously, we're in the initial stages of that process. We have a number of supporters, including our civilian leadership, who are making their views known, and we hope to have a favorable outcome with that particular follow-on mission.
But again, safe to say it's being considered replacement aircraft that may or may not do the same exact mission as the A-10. The A-10 is a pretty unique aircraft. I believe you yourself have even flown the A-10.
I have, and you're correct. It is a very capable aircraft. However, there are a number of aircraft that do similar, very critical jobs in our military.
We're talking with Brigadier General Leonard Isabel, the commanding officer of the Michigan Air National Guard. Let's talk about funding a bit, General. Just about a year ago, I spoke with Major General Gregory Vadney, who is the Adjutant General of the Michigan National Guard, and he told me at the time that over the next few years, the Air National Guard here in Michigan may be facing a disproportionate cut in terms of its profile against the entire national defense budget, and that is largely due to the A-10 program. Can you comment on what that really means on a national scope?
Well, again, that's an Air Force proposal. As you know, Congress has blocked that initial proposal, so currently we're at the status quo in that the A-10 aircraft is not allowed to retire this year in FY15. So in terms of the future, we hope to improve on that disproportionate cut to have more of an even effect in Michigan as compared to the rest of the force throughout the country.
And just to be clear, does a cut mean it is a cut in funding, or it is a lowering of personnel, or is it both? Or maybe you're just not getting a new allocation of funding?
Well, the root cause is that we have weapon systems in the state, such as A-10, that are being targeted for retirement. So that would translate to a loss of personnel if we do not get a follow-on mission that requires the same number of personnel.
What types of long-term plans do you have for the structure of the Michigan Air National Guard? And again, this goes back to the theme we've been talking about. How much control or say does the state of Michigan have versus what the Pentagon wants?
Well, we have a number of supporters, again, in our civilian leadership structure, our congressional delegations, community, et cetera. And they have made it known that they support our military and our continued service in the state of Michigan.
How many Michigan Air National Guard troops are on station somewhere in the world right now, just to get a sense of where the folks who report to you are serving?
Well, we have over 2,700 men and women in the Michigan Air National Guard, and right now approximately 350 of them are deployed overseas in service to their country.
And how big is the Air National Guard in Michigan compared to the total National Guard?
Well, we have approximately 8,500 Army National Guard soldiers and, again, 2,700 airmen in the state of Michigan.
Any final thoughts, General?
Well, I'd like to emphasize how proud I am of our men and women. Again, they're making a sacrifice to leave their loved ones and deploy in service to their nation. So I'm extremely proud of what they're doing. And I'd also like to thank our employers, our family members, and the members of the community for their unconditional support. It is truly amazing to see the support that our men and women are given.
Brigadier General Leonard Isabel is the commander of the Michigan Air National Guard. We've been talking about the deployment of troops from Selfridge Air National Guard Base near Detroit to face the threat of ISIS. General Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. For a while now, medical professionals have thought there was a connection between abdominal fat and high blood pressure. Turns out that belly fat may be more or less talking to the body's blood vessels, and Current State's Melissa Benbach joins me now with more. Hi, Melissa.
Mark, this is a really interesting story. The National Institutes of Health has given a grant to some MSU researchers who want to basically listen in on what that conversation might be. Dr. Greg Fink is a professor in pharmacology and toxicology at MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine and is at the head of the study. And I talked to him on Friday. The first thing I found out was not all belly fat is created equal.
Many people have something of a misconception about what belly fat really is. There's two types of fat in the body, the fat that's under the skin, subcutaneous fat, and of course there's lots of that under the skin of the belly. And there's also fat that's inside your abdomen, so it's fat that's around your organs, around your intestines and your stomach and your pancreas and so forth. The fat that is risky for you health-wise is the fat that's around your organs inside. It's not the fat that's on your belly but visible under the surface of the skin. We know this because many people these days have liposuction and get a great deal of their subcutaneous fat removed for cosmetic purposes. We know for certain that has no beneficial effect on their blood pressure or other measures of cardiovascular health. On the other hand, if you look at the level of fat in the abdomen itself around the organs, which we use special techniques to measure, that correlates pretty closely, very closely actually, with the problem of hypertension and other cardiovascular diseases. So our studies are about why that is. Why is it that fat in this one particular location, why is that the dangerous fat?
One of the things I saw in the press release about this was that you think there's a communication hormonally between the fat and blood vessels. Talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. So if one were to look at where the fat is inside the belly, you'll see it's very closely applied to the organs. It's essentially the organs are bathed in it. Fat is almost liquid at normal body temperature. And for a long time, it was thought that that was just coincidental. These two tissues, the fat and all the other organs, were just sort of located together. But subsequently, what we have found out, and others have contributed to this, is that there is a communication between the tissues. So the fat essentially talks to the other organs. And in our instance, because hypertension is a problem of blood vessels, we're interested in the blood vessels there. So the fat can actually talk to the blood vessels. And actually, interestingly enough, the blood vessels and other organs can talk to the fat. Now, this talk, of course, is not the way we're talking now, but this talk occurs via chemical means. So chemical signals are sent between the fat and the blood vessels and the fat. We think it's this communication that is disordered that is the reason that some people have cardiovascular disease associated with having belly fat is this communication is disordered or dysfunctional in some way.
If it's hormonal, it's not probably constant. How do you catch it at the right time?
As far as we know, that the fat in the body is not very static. It's not like it gets laid down early on and then never, ever changes. The fat in your body is constantly changing in response to different stimulation. For example, when you exercise, of course, fat breaks down. When you eat, you add lipids to the fat stores. In addition, what's now believed to be pretty important is the inflammation state of the fat. Fat, like all other tissues in the body, can become injured and inflamed. And what many people think, and I think our data is tending now to support, is that when the fat becomes inflamed, which it isn't always, but when it does become inflamed, that's when this communication between the fat and the blood vessels, the communication that we think is very important in causing high blood pressure, we think that's when the communication becomes such that the blood vessels respond to the messages they're receiving from the inflamed fat by constricting, getting smaller. And most people who know anything about blood pressure know when your blood vessels get smaller that the blood pressure goes up as a response. So that's the way we think it happens. And, of course, it's not always the case. If your fat doesn't have these changes, which we think is inflammation, then the communication will be pretty benign. The blood vessels will stay fairly wide open, and your blood pressure would stay down. That's our basic theory.
How are you going to find subjects for this?
So a lot of our work is done in animal models, and so they're not volunteers, of course. We dragoon them into our studies, and interestingly enough, animals overfed will get fat and accumulate fat in pretty much the same way other, you know, people animals accumulate fat, though it's much, much more difficult, actually, to get animals to be truly obese and overweight than humans, and we're not completely sure why, except that animals, when you feed them high-fat food or high-caloric diets, which is what we do, they tend to eat less. People often don't because they eat for different reasons than hunger, of course. So our animal subjects we purchase, and we breed some here as well. Human subjects, of course, many, many, many more restrictions hold for studies on human subjects. We've been very fortunate in having a collaboration going with surgeons here in town who do bariatric surgery. And many of the patients who undergo bariatric surgery will consent to us having the extra tissue that is removed from them as part of the normal surgery. We don't get any special tissue, but as part of bariatric surgery, fat is removed from the body, blood vessels are removed from the body. Typically, those are just disposed of, but instead, we have someone there to collect them. And then, of course, with patient's consent, obviously. We collect some medical data on them as well. We don't know who the patients are, but we get anonymized medical data. We can find out if they have hypertension or not, or if they have a metabolic disease, if they have glucose sensitivity, diabetes. And what we then do is compare the function and structure of the fat from and blood vessels from these people. And what our main goal here is to look at the function and structure of fat and vessels that come from healthy people, because there are lots of obese people that are otherwise very healthy, compared to those who are obese but not healthy, who have cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes, and other disorders. And we hope by looking at the differences between these two, we can find what it is that's the key factor. What's the key conversation that's going on in the people who are overweight or obese and have cardiovascular disease that's causing the problem?
What are you hoping to do with this knowledge?
Well, ultimately, of course, everybody who does biomedical research hopes to impact medical care and to make patients better. A lot of people don't realize this, but there are many complications of being overweight or obese, but the most serious by far from the standpoint of imposing a significant increase in morbidity or mortality is actually the cardiovascular consequences. So our goal is not really to find a way to help people lose weight. That's not our specialty. That's not our expertise. But our goal is to uncouple body weight, and particularly the accumulation of fat in the belly, from the cardiovascular consequences. So our dream would be to find a way to not keep people from being overweight, perhaps, but if they are overweight, that they will not have high blood pressure. Most of the cardiovascular consequences of being overweight are related to having high blood pressure. So if we can just find that connection, we can make people who have a difficult time losing weight a lot more healthy.
Why belly fat specifically? I mean, why not behind fat? Isn't that thought to be connected to high blood pressure?
That is an excellent, excellent question, actually. And that gets to the heart of what we're doing, because it's been known for a long time that the fat that accumulates in the belly seems to be uniquely linked. And our theory, what was really novel about what we're doing, is we think it's because it is local. Fat secretes hormones into the blood, and they can take those signals or that conversation anywhere in the body. And that's what the theory was in the past, that really the fat in the abdomen and the belly was creating hormones, sending it out all over the body, maybe working on the brain to tell the brain something, or working on blood vessels other places. We think that the blood vessels in the abdominal cavity are particularly important when it comes to controlling blood pressure. There's blood vessels all over the body, in the brain, in the kidneys, and in your muscles, and they all probably contribute to blood pressure. But our studies over the years have actually focused on the idea that it's the blood vessels in the intestinal organs, in the abdominal organs like the intestine, the stomach, and so forth, that are particularly important in blood pressure control. And so we think it's the fat being close by to these very important blood vessels. It's like being near the center of power. It's like being near Washington, D.C. You know, if you're a lobbyist, you want to be close, because that way your influence will be greater. So we think it's like that with the fat in the belly, too. It's important because it's close to the blood vessels that are important. That was the fundamental innovation in our proposal, that it was the proximity that mattered. People already knew that the belly fat was important, but they didn't know why. And so no one had ever proposed before that it was simply the proximity to the key blood vessels. So that's the theory that we're working on. That's why it's very important for us to get blood vessels not just from anywhere in the body, but we want them from the intestinal region. And people getting bariatric surgery, of course, that's where the surgery happens to be. So we're really quite fortunate in being able to get tissue from that source, and of course that's the population of interest as well, people that are quite overweight. Otherwise you wouldn't be getting bariatric surgery.
Well, Dr. Greg Fink, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. MSU football fans made history over the weekend. A record 48,000 people packed Spartan Stadium on Saturday to witness this year's green and white scrimmage. It was the largest attendance ever recorded for the spring tradition. The green and white intra-squad exhibition game showcases Michigan State's up-and-coming football talent. In the end, the white team came out on top, downing the green 9-3. Current sports host Al Martin was at the game and is here to recap the highlights. Hi, Al.
How you doing, Mark?
Good time. I love the spring game.
Oh, you got to love it, right? It's so relaxed, and it's more so for fun. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Any standout performances from Saturday?
Yeah, if I had to choose one, I would definitely say the defensive line. I mean, Michigan State's defensive line, of course, anchored by guys like Shalique Calhoun, Lawrence Thomas. I mean, they caused a lot of havoc in that backfield and also on respective quarterbacks for that game. I mean, it was very impressive to see the athleticism that defensive line brings to the table. Of course, when you talk about the running backs, and speaking of that backfield, you know, guys like Madre London, who had 70 yards on 9 carries, Gerald Holmes as well, 48 yards on 11 attempts. Those two guys are going to be – it's going to be interesting to see as the year progresses who has that starting running back position, because, of course, with the absence of Delton Williams and L.J. Scott, who's a freshman coming in, I mean, that could also add a little fire when he comes in for that position. But if I had to choose one in the backfield, it has to go with Gerald Holmes. They were impressive as well. And how about Connor Cook? I mean, he looked so comfortable. I tell you, when you're comparing both quarterbacks for the green and the white team, I mean, Connor Cook was 11 for 22, 105 yards. Tyler O'Connor looked a little bit uneasy. A lot of it had to do with, as I just stated, that defensive line. But in the end, Connor Cook looks, I mean, he could be one of the best quarterbacks, you know, in the nation this year, again.
Talk to us about Jack Allen's touchdown run.
How fun was that, Mark?
All about?
I mean, you're talking, you know, it's not often where you get to see these 300-pound linemen even touch the ball, let alone score a touchdown.
Right.
So, I mean, that had to be the highlight of that game, Jack Allen getting the handoff and just taking it to the house. And then the play before that, another offensive lineman, I mean, Donovan Clark, you know, just, you know, pressure came on Connor Cook. He improvises. He finds Clark to his right. And he had some daylight to take that thing all the way, Mark. So, I mean, that was so fun. It just shows you, a lot of people forget, I mean, even though these guys, you know, 300 pounds, they still play the game of football. And they were pretty athletic. I mean, you start to see a little bit of jets on the shoes of both Allen and Clark. It was a fun time.
How about that? WKAR current sports host Al Martin is talking to us about Saturday's green and white scrimmage. Broader view then, Al, how does the whole team look to you? We focused on a couple of individual performances here. Overall, what do you make of the team from Saturday?
Right. Well, I always say, I mean, when you talk about the spring game, Mark, take it with a bag of salt. Not a grain, but a big, huge bag. Because at the end of the day, it's the spring game. I mean, this game was nationally televised. It's an exhibition game, you know, an intra-squad game. So Mark D'Antonio and his coaching staff doesn't want to give away any sort of coaching schemes or tidbits throughout that game. It's more so for fun. I always say that. And just to see where guys are at condition-wise. And also, when you talk about the overall comfortability when it comes to an offense or defense. So at the end of the day, I mean, you saw Connor Cook. I think one thing that kind of peaks could possibly peek a window into something down the future is that I think Connor Cook is finding maybe his next receiver that he's fallen in love with. I mean, last year, of course, it was Tony Lippett. This year, how about De'Anthony Arnett? I mean, De'Anthony Arnett had 5 catches. He looked very comfortable with Cook. He had some crisp route running. So if anything, look out for Cook and Arnett to link up a lot of times next year.
We got only about 30 seconds, Al, but let me ask you about the two verbal commitments that Coach D'Antonio received on Saturday. Who are these guys?
Yeah, well, when you talk about them, I mean, they're guys from around the local region, one from Ohio in Lyles. And, of course, even before that, if you look at Messiah DeWeaver, who had committed right before the spring game. And Messiah DeWeaver is actually, he's the number one quarterback in the state of Ohio, number 8 quarterback, pro-style quarterback in the entire nation. Watch out for Messiah DeWeaver. Pretty cool name, right? Messiah DeWeaver. With a name like
really?
Messiah, you better be good, Mark.
Al Martin is the host of WKAR's Current Sports. We've been jawing a little bit here, a little Monday morning quarterbacking in April about MSU's spring game. Thanks, Al.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark.
And that's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State. Last November, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled to uphold bans on gay marriage in Michigan and 3 other states. Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case that could reverse the decision and make gay marriage legal in all 50 states. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta will be in Washington for the arguments and will join us by phone. Plus, bird enthusiasts have been reveling in the sights and sounds of spring with binoculars in hand. Peter Wharf talks to Claire Bratton at the Harris Nature Center about the tricks of the bird-watching trade. We should ask if that involves drones. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery. You can hear past episodes of Current State at WKAR.org or subscribe to our podcast. Glad you could join us. It's Current State on WKAR.